Good morning
Morning,
and
welcome
to a brand new and sparkly edition of The Burning Platform. We're properly into summer, and I think that this is probably going to be one of the most interesting conversations we have all year. And that's saying something because it's been a hell of a year. Have you remembered that we once had an election? Have you remembered that we, just a little while ago, we had something called the Government of National Unity, which people were super excited about? I don't know if that excitement is still there. In 19 days from now, we've got the U.S. presidential election coming up. And just when you thought you could go on a December holiday, there's going to be stuff happening all over the world. Pumi told me last night that Kim Jong-un has blown up a bunch of roads in North Korea. We've got China
strategically blowing up roads.
We've got China patrolling ominously and aggressively around the island of Taiwan.
Listen, military exercises, in-air military exercises. They say it's exercises, but you're going to wake up one day and you're going to be dropping bombs. I'm just saying.
Soon, maybe Taiwanese will not be a thing. Who knows?
Bosnia is flaring up.
Bosnia, I mean, listen. All right. So, in other words, it's a good day to collect our thoughts and join together on the Burning Platform. So welcome. If you have just joined us, Pumi Mashiho, always good to see you, Pums. And this morning we have an incredible guest, someone who I've actually been very keen to talk to for a very long time. So bear with me because this is actually an introduction worth going step by step through. He's an associate professor of public and development management and a former convener of the Political Economy School of Governance at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. He's also a professor of management in Elsenburg Stellenbosch, a multiple number one best-selling award-winning South African author, and ran the course on public policy, including how to put together the national budget for members of parliament of all political parties in South Africa, a skill we sorely need. He is also the founder and executive chairperson of Democracy Works Foundation, among other organizations, and the independent chairperson of the negotiations to establish a multi-party coalition of opposition parties in the 2024 South African national and provincial elections, the so-called Moonshot Pact, which they don't like us calling it that anymore, but he was the man who was...
They've rebranded.
Well, I think we've just like completely moved on. I mean, everything about that, and we'll talk to him in a second about it, but everything about that's changed, right? He is none other than... Professor William Gumede, it is a great pleasure to have you here, sir.
No, good morning. I'm very happy to be with you, and you dragged me out of bed very early today. I actually just taught you, I'm kind of with my last son's writing matric this year, not waking up at 5 o'clock.
Look what we've done.
I'm
sorry.
This is just think of it as a little bit of nostalgia.
So where do we begin? I mean, maybe because Pumi and I both hopped on that multi-party negotiation that you had before the elections. I mean, with the advent of the GNU, does that just like cancel out everything?
Because
that
you were in the room.
Yeah.
You were in the room when it happened. So...
No, absolutely. I'll start off just to say, you know, when the Government of National Unity was announced, Jacob Zuma made a statement in his first press conference. I mean, his kind of first salvo was the ANC joined a multi-party charter. The ANC joined a Moonshot Pact. That's what he said. Now there's a grain of truth in it. That's a grain of truth.
So then you could be the master puppeteer. You could actually be the man who's put us in this position now. So how much responsibility do you take?
I mean, just think about this. I mean, when they, more than a year ago, when they approached me and said, look, we want to put together a grouping, first time ahead of the election. We don't want to go like in the past, a local government election. Lots of our coalitions, governing coalitions at the local level fail because, you know, when they get there, they haven't thought about how they're going to govern, what they're going to do, and so on. Now, if you do it before the time, I mean, if you look around the world, it's very likely to be more successful if you're in government. So they came to me and said, look, we need an independent person. We can't agree. I mean, we're starting and screaming at each other. We've been trying this thing. Clearly, we need an outsider to kind of help us. So, and the mandate for them was, look, put it together and for them to bring the ANC below 50%. And then the result of the 29 May election was the ANC got below 40%. I mean, after the audits, the IEC audit, consolidated audit, the IEC actually got 39 plus.
Very, very.
I mean, that's just astonishing. Think about
that's it. A hard blow for them.
Yeah. So from a multi-party charter point of view, so obviously then, I mean, in any country, when the opposition bring down a governing party, the opposition should put together a government. Now, our case was very difficult to do that because there was MK on one hand, Jacob Zuma, the EFF on the other hand. These two parties were what we would call populist parties with kind of really outsized demands. They didn't want to work with the DA or with the IFP in the Moonsault pack. And the opposition parties, the multi-party charter, couldn't put it together. The ANC had the same struggles with MK and the EFF. I mean, MK wanted Ramaphosa to quit before they agreed. EFF wanted Floyd Zimbabwe to be the finance minister. I mean, these sort of, you know, demands, it really is far beyond.
I forgot about them proffering Floyd Chivambu as Minister of Finance. That would have been embarrassing if he suddenly hopped ship to MK as Minister of Finance, wouldn't it?
Rank us kind of almost.
South Africans, you have such short memories.
I'm afraid
you
so.
You forget that we have also had floor crossing in this country. So people we come from a place where things like that were not an anomaly. Many people cross the floor with their portfolios. And so why would it have been any different for Floyd? But I do have this question. You know, prior to the election, and with lots of talk around coalitions and how coalitions work around the world, many, many delegations from many different political parties went on lots of fact-finding missions to European countries and the like, and still came back and were unable to agree or coalesce around particulars around this thing. What does that then mean now that the multi-party charter has sort of fallen through an AGNU with 10 of the 14 political parties as part of that formation? Last night we were talking about it being a supermajority for Cyril Ramaphosa. What does that then mean for how this thing can work, if at all, and last, if at all?
Yeah. I mean, let me just quickly conclude on the MPC in the election and why they're in government. So when the election outcome came out, and it, you know, it was just so different, such a surprise. MK came out of nowhere. And nobody, including me, expected them to get that kind of amount. So the tally. And then a decision from an MPC group was like, what do we do now? What do they do now? Yes, the ANC is below 40%. But they can't put together a government because they needed the EFF and the MK. What do you do? The alternative here would be the ANC. And that was the big decision that was made. X and SA, the ACDP decided, well, they're not agreeing with such a decision. Yeah. They would rather go to the opposition benches. And that's also, that's when I said that Jacob Zuma said it was the MPC plus the ANC. So in a sense, it was then the MPC group minus X and SA minus the ACDP with the ANC, and that's the government that was formed. So essentially, the MPC is in government.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's a big claim. I don't know if the ANC would like that claim, but I suppose what's happened is what's happened.
Well, some people.
So what was it like? And I always like a little bit of revision, because we will read the history of this time in 10, 15 years from now, and they may have a very different approach to how it all happened. So the more information we have, the better. First of all, why do you think they asked you to take such an important role in the multi-party coalition? And what was it like kind of herding the cats at that stage? Before, now we're talking before the election, and then post then, kind of, has there been a role for you in actually putting it all together?
I mean, before I get to just this, I mean, I know I didn't respond to the question about coalitions. The thing that people don't understand, many people don't understand, and sometimes not even believe, is that coalitions around the world, the last 50 years, has actually been one of the best models of government.
Yeah.
Delivered growth. for many countries, delivered employment and stability. I mean, across the world, so both in the developed countries, but also in industrial countries. I mean, in Africa, you would ask me, well, what has been the most successful model since the end of independence? And independence has been, I mean, the first, when Liberia became independent in the 1800s, so we're talking about almost under 200 years of independence, you would say, well, what could it be? Is it liberation movements? Were they the most successful? Is it military leaders? Were they successful? No. Coalitions. So out of 54 African countries that since independence, just over 180 years ago when Liberia became independent, it's been coalition governments. Mauritius, the longest coalition government for over three decades, longest growth spurt in Africa's history. For example, the Gambia, when they were in a coalition, I mean, you know, the terrible dictators there. Stability was during that period. In Botswana, they had an equivalent of the GNU in the early years that really centered their country, stabilized it, and so on. So coalitions, and if you look abroad, I mean, think of the great Brazilian economic miracle and stability. Because think of Brazil after the Second World War, always been military rule. When the military rule ended, it's been coalition parties. And when I say coalition, we're talking about 10, 11 party coalitions consistently for decades. And not just coalitions that like all the parties look alike. It's coalitions where you have, like, let's just say the current coalition with Lula da Silva is from the Workers' Party. You know, it's kind of the pillar of the coalition. But there's about 10 parties in that coalition with parties, Catholic parties in one extreme, like really on the right. And then you have the left, the Workers' Party. So across the ideology, it's been really working. And of course, in the Western world, Germany, and there's been coalition governments since the end of the Second World War. Switzerland has had Switzerland has had no government since the Second World War that hasn't been a coalition.
Okay, but then the question about why you think they asked you, and did you willingly go into this? Because, I mean, that's a hell of a thing for anyone to try and wield and to try and control. And then what was it like herding the cats?
I mean, when they asked me, like, I was asking my friends, and they said, absolutely no.
Stay away.
It's like, this is never going to work. I mean, political parties in South Africa, we know in the post-1994 period, I mean, there's egos. I mean, a lot of our political parties should not be political parties. They should be NGOs. I mean, they should not even go and campaign there and go look for votes. They should be pleasure groups, NGOs, and so on. I mean, these are, you know, people start parties as a meal ticket. Many of these parties are meal tickets. It's employment opportunity.
I just want to pause there because that is such a good point to make. Some of our political parties, some of these political parties should be NGOs, like one man band NGOs. They can get their funding.
If you're an NGO, there's an expectation that you do some good. And I don't know if...
Yeah, I know a lot of them that don't.
I'm just saying.
I guess when a political party is easier, there's no expectation to go. Once you get your voting base, you send it out, you say the kind of usual things for the public and so on. You anti-test and so on. But on a serious note, just in terms of, I mean, number one, the egos. I mean, we just got too many parties. Obviously, in a democracy, you know, there's a freedom of people to form their political party. So I'm not saying, you know, we should stop that. But we really, for our country, a lot of the parties should actually combine. And this has been my view for years to start off with. Secondly, that some parties should, if they don't want to combine, actually have a permanent coalition. I mean, in Germany, for example, there's been parties that have been in permanent coalition since the Second World War. You know, the same in Sweden or the same in Brazil and so on. So that's the first. The second one, so my view, even again, prior to the negotiations was that South Africa, as the world's most diverse society, cannot have a monopoly party. I mean, when I say monopoly, one dominant party like the ANC. cannot, it's not fit for purpose in a diverse society like our society. I mean, also, we, as I say, we're the world's most diverse society. I mean, like, we talk differently, we look differently, and we all combine here, the corner of Africa. This is, you know, this is our country. We need a diversity party, but not a, like, super diverse. I'm sort of thinking, and parties need to work together. So that, for me, was a really...
It's a bit
really
of a balancing
act. Like, yeah, to try to get a balancing...
Yeah, well, the ANC together. Would tell you they are a broad church. But, having said that, we do, though, even as you talk about where the coalitions are working in Germany and Brazil, is you have a strong anchor that has a very clear drive and a very clear... set of policies that they are pushing, that they bring people around, that they bring a consensus around. And here we sit with two dominant parties within this 10-party coalition who tell us that they are actually on opposite sides of the scale. And then we talk about the failings of what's going on there, right? Are all of these parties, have they joined this coalition in order to just ratify whatever the ANC is pushing? My own personal view is that they've given Cyril Ramaphosa a backdoor into power, into a seriously consolidated superpower, really, because now with this formation, he essentially has 70% of parliament kowtowing to him.
And he's not responsible to either party.
And they've already, and we see it even with some of the complaints that people have, right? One of the biggest ones being around the issue of Palapala and the dollars in the couch and how that has been treated.
And it won't go away.
It won't go away. Thank goodness for Jacob Zuma. Thank goodness for Jacob Zuma and Julius Malema. It won't go away. But he does have 70% of the people on his side saying, we're not going to entertain this thing any further.
You know, you're absolutely right. You know, coalitions with the government, national unity or super coalition need anchor parties. One anchor party or anchor parties. Okay, that's, you're right. But a coalition is not about the anchor parties. Policies does not dominate the coalition. And that is an important thing to understand. And this is what the GNU is failing, but ANC members failing, because our culture since 1994, with a dominant ANC in power since 1994, has been majority-based decision-making because the ANC has had the power. But in a coalition, it's not majority-based. So even if you're an anchor party with most votes, in a coalition that worked around the world, your view, because you're the anchor party, you've got the most vote, is not the dominant view. You have to agree on consensus. So I think the GNU will succeed or fail based on whether the ANC can undo its culture of dominant decision-making thinking. During the negotiations, when you were asking me again, in terms of when GNU was put together, I advise, the multi-party charter group to say, when you go into those negotiations, you ask for a consensus-based decision-making, make it formal. It has to be formal. Even if you get less positions in cabinet, if you can get an agreement on consensus, it will make up for having less positions. And I try to explain to them why is that? Because in the consensus decision making is different from majority decision making. It is used to just majority decision making, but in a consensus, if the biggest party has the view during a conflict, their view, the party has to compromise and listen and bring on board the rest of the parties. That's a very, very important. So actually, and that is what the ANC is struggling with right now.
Like real politics, is you've got to reach across the aisle and bring people to your side. That's real politics. That's, it's putting aside your differences and saying, what is the best thing for the country? What is the best thing for our economy? What is the best thing for the people? Yeah. And how do we put aside our differences? But we've got such big egos.
Interesting. And extraordinary, actually, if you look just obviously now from an academic point of view, as studying governments, now the last 100 years in countries that has been governed by consensus, they've delivered the best growth and stability, not majority-based decision-making. So let's just give you an example. I mean, after the Second World War, think about Japan. I mean, Japan totally destroyed. Mm. I mean, they recover within a space of 30 years, it becomes the second biggest economy after the US. I mean, from total destruction. Yeah. And they're driven by consensus-based decision-making. Why consensus-making? There's like a magic about this consensus-based decision-making. You know, the magic is you actually have to put aside your interests, your party interests, your ethnic groups. It's just your color interests. You say, okay, what is the big interest? This is a country's interest.
Well, I mean, this
Japan
is a question.
Japan is also a monolithic society, right? It's all the people are Japanese.
Yeah, and this relates to Dirk's question here. But these countries that the prof has mentioned, Germany, Brazil, et cetera, have far fewer challenges in the terms of race and internal tribalism. And that obviously goes across languages, cultures, all that kind of thing. South Africa is a unique case study in implementing coalition politics. Would you agree with that?
No. But, I disagree totally.
Okay. I also want to say, before you disagree, also Japan has the longest ruling party. They
So you disagree?
Disagree.
Okay. Let me explain. Let's go, with a view on Brazil, right? Brazil has also it is the world's second most diverse society in the world.
Hmm?
It's the second most diverse. I mean, it's as simple as that. The diversity, inequality, and poverty, and so on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But some people would argue it hasn't worked. I mean, you jump from a center-right government to a center-left government, and they're all trying to put each other in prison the whole time. I mean, how do you argue that that's good? The economics, perhaps you can say, more stable
than ours.
But politics looks like it's a winner-take-all situation if you're an outside observer.
No, they've actually done better. Remember where they started off with? We have to think how, after the Second World War, that whole period of military rule, violence, all sorts. I mean, like really the typical African type of Second World War situation, military in charge, sort of dictators.
Hunter,
and so on. Like, that's actually
strong man politics.
And so on to where they are now. I mean, the growth and the economic rise and the general stability across their society. Yes, and now they are with the politics of it's in fact, I mean, it's the politics of different coalitions being in control. For me, that's much more exciting than having military rule.
Oh, hell yes. I think that's preferable.
It's more preferable. Let's go to, the question was in Japan. Mm. Let's go to Japan. I mean, for me, I get very excited about Japan. Yes, it's a monolithic society, but think about where they came from. I mean, this is total, Hiroshima, all kind of total destruction. I mean, the country was totally destroyed, right? What they did is, in the magic, and it's kind of a lesson for many countries, is after the war, essentially every party and leader that existed before was told by society to leave. It's like, it's almost like, let's think about it.
Including the emperor.
Yeah, including the emperor. It was like almost like a year zero. Think about it, like our 1994 end of the parties. If it was a year zero, ANC goes, National Party goes, everyone goes.
Mm-hmm.
Start all new parties, new people who's never been in politics because the old elites were totally discredited. And that's actually the beauty of Japan. I mean, they start it all off and say, well, actually, all these political parties, whether it's the governing parties previously, which is the king or
the imperial government. Yeah, sure.
All of them, you brought us into this war, destroy Japan, go. We're going to create a whole new set of, totally new people. I mean, and I imagine, it's just like a total change and that whole new group, many of them who's never been in politics, begin to create the miracle of Japan over the period, of that post-war growth that like, went all the way until 1919 for Japan to become the second biggest economy in the world in the late 80s.
Yeah, and obviously we don't have a day zero because we have, and South Africa, whenever we're in trouble, we love looking back and complaining about things. It's like a depressed person. And if we look too far into the future, we get anxious. But in the present, and this is where I need your eye to the future, and Pumi's good at this too, this prediction. So with what's going on at the moment, let's just cut to what most people are interested in right now. Panyaza Lesufi and the ANC in Gauteng are definitely kicking up a lot of dust, which is embarrassing for Cyril in his coalition at national level. I heard this morning, I checked on X, Penwell, who's a friend of ours here, Penwell said to Panyaza, why don't you just leave and join MK? I mean, that would be the ultimate rebellion. But I don't think Panyaza will do that. He thinks he can be the next president or deputy president of the ANC. Who's going to win this battle between these elephants?
Battle of wills.
And how much damage are they going to do where they fight?
Before they get there.
I mean, the biggest risk for the GNU is actually the ANC. It's actually the business in the ANC. Nothing else. It's not the fight between the ANC and the DA.
No.
That's not the biggest risk for the stability of the GNU. The biggest risk is the fight within the ANC. For, you know, the biggest fights in the ANC, the biggest division since 1994 is now, you know, in the past, the fights were the left and the right and the populists and so on. Now the fight is for or against the GNU. And the ANC's leadership, is, you know, those who, the succession of Ramaphosa is also going to be determined by that. So essentially what's happening in that internal fight, so the internal fight pro against the GNU will also resolve the ANC's succession battle, you know, who takes over from Ramaphosa. Let me explain like why I'm saying that. Right now, who will take over from Ramaphosa is actually quite open. I mean, Ramaphosa also made a mistake that Mbeki also made, not grooming a capable successor, right? So there's a vacuum. There's a vacuum. So, but three candidates right now is Lesufi in Gauteng, Fikile Mbalula, General Secretary,
and
then this older Paul Masechile as the Deputy President. I mean, Paul Masechile is also interesting. His position appears to be, from where I'm sitting, it seems to be he's trying to be neutral, trying to get like enough votes, potentially, if it gets to a vote. The group that's pro and the group that's anti try to get enough of those votes, sort of a middle ground. Mbalula is in the sort of Ramaphosa camp now, where, you know, pro-GNU, that's his campaign, it's going to be pro-GNU.
He's hedged his bets. Yeah.
Lesufi is on the anti. I mean, and so on. So, and then coming to Ramaphosa, you know, since 1994, no ANC president completed a full second term.
Yes.
And Ramaphosa's, whether Ramaphosa will bug the trend, will also depend on whether the GNU is successful. If the GNU is not successful, when it gets to the ANC's elective conference in 2027, because he won't, you know, he wouldn't be able to stand for another term as ANC president, but he would be the country president. If the GNU is not successful, they may not let him continue to be the state president, almost like with Zuma and with Mbeki. So can you see, like, this? All right, same with GNU.
But there's another aspect around the success or failure of the GNU that I think no one has spoken as much about. I've seen you write about it. Is the fact that the hegemony of the ANC goes a little bit deeper than just the battles within the party, right? Because they have this policy of cadre deployment, what you have is you have ANC people everywhere. You have ANC people as DGs, you have ANC people as CEOs of entities, as board members, all across. And I remember you were also part of Cyril Ramaphosa's task team around professionalizing the public service. So what has that look like? And how does that play out in terms of a success or failure of the GNU? Because you may have a minister that's a DA minister, but everybody that works in that department, or most of the people that work in the department, are members in one way or another of the ANC's beast.
I mean, you are right. The public service is also a risk for the GNU, because, you know, the sad part of cadre deployment, not only here, but around the world. So the moment you put your cadres based on politics, not on competence, not on merit, and so on, you put them into the public service, you then create almost like a party state, you know, it's like the party state becomes the same. So if the party's in trouble, the party's corrupt and toxic and so on, the state becomes toxic. And that's going to be the problem. If you, let's say, you know, IFB minister in this GNU, or you, or Patriotic Alliance Minister Gator McKenzie, you inherit then a public service. So we've got a public service. The top leadership of that public service is ANC countries. Many of them have been appointed there, not because they're competent or good and so on. It's because of politics or patronage and so on. And that's why the public service has failed. I mean, I was part of the task team, the inquiry on looking at the public service. How can we professionalize it? How can we restructure cabinet, reduce it? What do we do? And if you look at it, you know, the reason for its failure, one of the biggest reasons is just it's not a professional public service. It's a politicized public service. And so you got like the deployment, but you actually get another deployment, which is a different deployment, is the unions, public service unions aligned with the ANC. So at the lower ranks, these are like, you know, aligned, trade unions aligned to the ANC.
Mapaila is very unhappy about the GNU.
You can't fire them, because if you fire them, they go to the union, the union leaders go to the ANC, and they say, no way, you can't fire them. And that is why it's been so difficult to reform the public service, but also to reform state-owned entities, because, you know, and even to deal with, you know, procurement, because it's all the same. So the GNU will also fall or stand based on whether there can be a turnaround in the public service and so on. So if you're going to be an IFB minister or a DA minister, you know, you've been inherit an ANC department actually dominated with cadres.
So you're saying they're going to have to clean house?
Absolutely have to.
What is happening? Because yesterday we had an event here at the podcast party with, among other guests, we had the great Justice Malala, and he asked some very tough questions of Action SA and Bosa, who I jokingly said, it's like asking dodos what they think of Mauritius in 5 years' time, you know, and are they going to really be players? But the fact is that Michael Beaumont of Action SA was very scathing about the fact that there are all these departments that have not got directors general. There are people at various levels in Chapter 11 institutions, Chapter 9 institutions that do not have boards. Some have overstayed their welcome. They're in breach of...
It was Nobuntu, from Bosa.
So is there, and I heard someone else at the event last night, and these are, you know, usually quite informed people. Is there anything going on behind the scenes that we don't know about, that maybe you do, because you're so connected to all these people, about professionalizing the civil service, about getting private sector people in where the private sector might even be paying for these people? And government has made the deal that, okay, as long as you're paying and you are sure that these are people with MBAs and people, we've got lots of qualified and brilliant people in this country. And they've stayed away from the public organizations and gone for private for personal greed reasons normally, but also because they haven't really felt like they would be put to use in the public sector. Is there something going on there that we ought to be optimistic about? Or is that just someone who was talking nonsense in my ear?
Yeah. You know, if there was a magical wand for the GNU, listen to me on this one. It's just, if they right now bring in the private sector and NGOs to deliver, they're part of the public service. There is, let me tell you, it's not working and it's not going to work in the next year. I mean, that's just the truth. I know there's a whole lot of people, you know, who don't understand that fact, would think, well, actually, the state is going to work. You just need a different political party. I've now been on two inquiries. You know, I was also part of the inquiry in 2009 on the review of state-owned entities. And let me tell you, some state-owned entities should not exist. We should just close them down. I mean, they're so bad.
Which ones?
Let's go back. Or if that's for a conversation, I said,
which ones? Now I want to know. You brought it up.
Let's just go back. So, but actually, the low hanging fruit, I mean, there's something about our country which is the competitiveness of our country sits often in the non-state, but which ANC leaders up to now haven't seen. I mean, when I tell them, say, look at me, I mean, are you coming from Mars? What are you talking about? Why do I say this? If you think about a public service is doing so badly in our state-owned entities, so incompetent, so ineffective. Sure. And then you have some of our private sector companies and even some of our NGOs that do very well. Now, in countries that grow and do very well, versus Japan or Brazil or Mauritius, you have a closer, your public service and your state-owned companies and your private sector are almost equal in their performance.
Mm.
Not, I mean, we've got the most skewed performance between, we've got, like, you think of a bank, a Standard Bank or a Capital Bank performing, and then you have a land bank, state bank.
Yeah, sure. And funny enough, yeah. I mean, we do pay our public sector workers almost an equivalent amount of money.
Absolutely.
Despite their competence difference.
Yeah. And that also brings me to another thing is in terms of what people don't understand is that when you have a state-owned company, the only way a state-owned company can work anywhere in the world is that you have more competent people in a state-owned company than in the private sector. Okay, I'm going to just to repeat that. So if let's just say the land bank, if you want the land bank, which is a state-owned bank, to work, it must have more competent people than Standard Bank.
Mm.
Otherwise, it can't work.
Understand that their mandate
absolutely is
public different. But
not to be confused, it's not just your so state-owned companies, it's not just a mandate of public service, but it's a mandate also of you have to be effective.
Yeah,
otherwise what's the point of having a public service?
So yeah. This is one thing, and I'm being unkind about Michael and Nubuntu yesterday, but Nubuntu said something I thought was very true across the board. And, you know, even parties that get 6 seats can sometimes say something that's true. 2 seats. She was right about this, that we need consequence management. We need to be able to, and I think the problem with state-owned entities, and this is something you've written about before, because I've read you saying something similar to this, is that there isn't a victory condition for a state enterprise. Because the government will bail you out if you don't do your job and if you're terrible at it.
Yeah.
And if you do very well, you won't get any credit. So there's no reason for anyone who's ambitious to get into the public service or a state-owned enterprise unless they are a true servant or a true cadre.
Yeah.
And both of those are quite different people.
Yes. I mean, so in the theory of state-owned entities, and is there's a weakness of a state-owned entity is that it's going to be bailed out if it fails. Because people say, well, actually, we need jobs. And secondly, the state-owned company must provide a service, a public service. And that is why in the countries that has used state-owned companies, they've been very brutal to hold people accountable. I mean, in China, if you're a CEO of a state-owned company, if you mismanage, I mean, they don't know, you know, in the past, they may actually execute you. Mm. I mean, this is not for corruption.
Now they just disappear.
So you see the accountability.
In China, they disappear. In Japan, they kill themselves.
Idea of same in Japan. I mean, you're right. You know, the post-World War periods in Japan. So if you're going to run a state-owned company and we're not talking about corruption. We're just talking about, you know, performing. I
mean, well, that was the CEO of Mattel who killed himself because he put lead in the paint and hadn't dealt with that in the factories. He was like, well, I can't handle this. I'm just going to fall on my sword, literally.
So that is, you know, when you say consequence management, so a state-owned entity, and it's really, this is so fundamental to the workings of state-owned entity. If a country can have a state-owned company, we can have to be hold people so accountable to the point almost of death. You know, you don't deliver, you execute it. Obviously, this is a democracy. We're not going to execute people. But, you know, if you get an idea.
Consequence.
Yeah. I mean, in countries, for example, I think you'd have a little bit, maybe a softer approach. In South Korea, for example, they don't execute it, but they did execute people like 60 or 70. But, okay, let's go to the 80s. What happens there is that you can, if you found to be ineffective and corrupt, you'll never, ever again work, not only in the public sector, but also not in the private sector.
No one will touch you. You're like poison.
You're done. Mm. Done for.
Yeah. Saudi Mutswene. I mean, who's going to hire him? I think that happens. The market takes care of that anyway, doesn't it?
But he can join him.
Yeah, he can. He can. That's true.
And find himself in the committee that has oversight over SAPC. This is true.
There's endless rehabilitation available to very bad people.
But then at the risk of goading you into a lecture, what I'm most interested in is around, as a governance scholar, are really the issues that we need to consider deeply as South Africans regarding how our government works.
Yeah.
And can the GNU deliver that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, really, we need to value performance, competence ahead of political party affiliation, ahead of color, ahead of ethnicity, and ahead of my village. You know, we come from my village, so... if you don't perform, and so on. So we have competence need to trump everything. And that really is when we talk about you know, the Asian economic miracles, how did these societies turn around like that? Is competence above everything else? And merit above everything else. And I know the conversation about merit in our country, given our past, is not an easy conversation. It, you know, it has to be imaginative. And it's a complex conversation, but there has to be a measure of merit even in affirming. It has to be based on merit. Otherwise, we're never going to deal with poverty. We're not going to get a competence. We're not going to get our government working. It's not going to happen.
Prof, how much of that, because I completely agree with you, but I don't think merit needs to be something which is frightening. I wonder if the merit part of what so many people in the ANC and perhaps MK, what they hate about it isn't so much that it is a fact of competence, but that it is an ideological inheritance. It's a left-wing thing to imagine that everyone is the same and that if you just give them the job, that they'll do it. And the competence doesn't really come into it.
I wonder if
you know, good old school Marxism doesn't just need to be rinsed out of the political fabric of this country so that people can look around and realize we have tremendously talented and capable people of all races and tribes and languages and backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And that if we put them in the right places, and maybe this is what the electorate was trying to say. Everybody's trying to read what the election results were. No party was given an absolute majority. No party was given the mandate to lead necessarily. Mm-hmm. What the South African electorate may be saying is, hey, why don't you just look a little bit more like society, where we're all actually trying to get on with it and people just want to make a future for themselves and their children?
Absolutely. I think we have to get as a country out of this sort of fake revolutionary type of Marxist
comrade language. Comrade this and comrade,
we have to get out of land.
If you think so about 1970s. This,
I mean, our country's almost, I don't know, I don't want to say, but you know, it seems like we're like frozen. like in the 70s and 80s, in a way, we're talking about the revolution death, Marxist, Leninist death, the status. It's like, I don't think, most probably, we're like, the only other country that most probably is like us would be North Korea. I mean, no. I'm telling you, in terms of being stuck in a sort of Marxist, Leninist lingo. I mean, let's go to China. In China, everyone talk about your entrepreneurs of building big industries going to dominate the world. Companies is going to dominate the world. They want to dominate. Is it a private sector? Yeah, we're talking about, you know, let's create a Marxist, Leninist state.
I agree with you.
Soviet Union has failed terribly. Every African country for 180 years who tried it has failed. I mean, there's 54 African countries, but half of them tried some kind of Marxist-Leninist things for under 200 years. We wanted to repeat that. I mean, it's like, it seems so illogical that part dominates our politics. So if the GNU can bring us back to sensible politics, to be pragmatic again and get us away from this sort of wild stuff that has failed anywhere else and that is dominating our politics, you know, to get to, again, to rational people. In a sense, I think the failure of many African countries, and we run a risk of it, is that people vote for people who, if they get to power, it's going to be very harmful. So you vote for somebody who screams and shouts Marxist, Leninist stuff, number one, you know, revolution this, revolution that. Or you vote for people who are very violent. Or you vote for people who tell you they're going to give you everything, nirvana, heaven, everything. And they give you hell on earth once they get into power. But we don't vote for people who are sensible and who are competent and so on. So we're going to have a mindset. It's almost like a psychological change. Mm-hmm. So the people who are sensible, who are competent, who are honest, are not going to please you by, they're not going to say to you, I'm going to give you everything. You're going to get up. Everyone's getting a house and a job. We're going to create many more state-owned companies. But what they will give you is they'll get into power. They'll be honest and they'll try their best. And they're going to deliver for you. But they're not going to speak the kind of wild speak and so on. And I think, if we can make that stuff and so on. I mean, there's some people, who said, bring us a military, like, you know, sure. Rest of Africa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, the rest of Africa's been under military.
I mean, I'd like to know, let's start with which generals, like, which generals would you like, you know?
General Shockwave.
But I mean, Azalea says here, but prof, we teach these Marxist things at universities in South Africa, which is true, right?
No, but prof, similar to what Azalea is saying, if you consider that China today seems to be living the dream, right? People are driving Havals and Beijings and whatever on the road.
Beijings.
On the road. Apparently, there's a plant. They're assembling some of them out in Port Elizabeth. Where, on the other side, right, VW, which used to be 1 in 3 cars on the road were VW cars, is in trouble. They're having major problems. Mm-hmm. Industry is slowing down across Europe. Mm-hmm. And so they're having to reconsider how they are engaging with the rest of the world. China has had unprecedented growth over the past 30 years. They are shipping into everywhere in the world, right? What we're talking about, green energy and whatever, everybody gets their solar panels from China. They've just tanked 2 factories in India, where India get most of their components, and they decided that they were going to get into this market. Mm-hmm. China came in there and wiped the floor with them. The government of India put so much money into creating an industry around solar panels. China came in then and wiped it out. And so now China is the biggest supplier of solar paneling in India. Yeah. They're living the dream.
But it's certainly not because of ideology. Pragmatism.
But when you sit here and you consider that, well, China and the CCP, this is what they're doing. This is how they've got prosperity in their country. People are this.
The ANC tried to sell that. But Figile Mbalula tried to sell that.
Everything changed in China. Why did China go the way it's... I mean, why is it growing? Why does the sovereignty collapse? 2 things. I mean, other things, but two key things for me. The first thing is they decided after the Cultural Revolution in China to bring in the private sector and entrepreneurs.
Deng Xiaoping.
That's it. Critical. Number one. So that is, for those who don't read, sadly, I want to make a side about reading because this is going to myself. Interesting. You know, as a society, we're not reading. And that is why we're stuck in this Marxist-Leninist. And this is also why we don't see all of the failures of policies before. And that is why we want to repeat the policies. I mean, people don't read what happens in Zimbabwe, and then people want Zimbabwean policies in South Africa. And then they see this Zimbabwe is in South Africa. And they're like, because they don't read, it's like, why are these people, why are Zimbabweans? Yeah, because the country has failed, and then we want to use the same failed policies and support it and so on. So it's a reading culture. And actually, one of the things about also China and all of these East Asian economic countries, and even the other economies in the developed world, reading, widespread deep reading, was one of the major changes in those societies, where you get people to read widely and to understand their own countries widely. I mean, yes, some people in our country who are even politicians, the village is not out of their head.
No.
You know, they love the village.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about it, they think the South Africa and the world is their village. So it's like, I asked them, you come over police, or okay, in case again, right? Police. I didn't think this is the world, this is the whole of South Africa. So then you make policies based on your village.
Yeah.
And you don't make policies based on the country and the diversity of the country. And so, maybe a big part of the journey we can have a reading culture, so we all read.
Yeah, it's widespread.
But let me come back to the Chinese. I mean, the second thing that the Chinese done is they brought, so first they said, let's build a private sector that's going to dominate the world. Okay, real ambition, right? And so on. Then they said, let's get economic growth going. Yeah, in South Africa, there are some people who said economic. I mean, economic growth is not even seen as a serious thing.
No.
Nowhere in Africa since the second world have people focus on growth. I mean, it's like a byproduct. Growth is the thing. If a country doesn't grow, you're not going to get the jobs and you're not going to get new business and so on. Yeah, in South Africa, the people are opposed to business, opposed to entrepreneurs. They want the state to have. The Chinese said, let's just build entrepreneurs. We can support them. Let them go and control the world, and that's how we're going to control the world. And then they brought in merit based into the public service. Like, I mean, any person, just go Google.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every year, so in China, you can only enter the public service if you are the top. If your marks at the end of school is the top.
So the number of
PhDs China's Mo Rabbit
says here in the comments, I worked in China for 4 years. They may be communist politically, but they focus pragmatic and they reward merit. But most important, probably, they plan long term and fully commit all sectors to those goals.
Absolutely. I mean, every year, just like imagine as we now, it's the matric year in South Africa. Right. And then, after matric, you get like your top students, a big celebration. So in China, only the top students will enter the civil service. And the same in Singapore, the same in South Korea, and the same in Taiwan. No one else.
Independent of ideology, because those are very different.
Independent of ideology.
So
they've cleaned the public service of ideology. Here you have the party. And then the second thing is they brought in professionalization into the party leadership. So any of your listeners, Google the Central Executive Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. The majority of people there have engineering degrees, technical degrees, right? And then you go back for the last 20 years and look at every central, committee of the Communist Party. About 80% plus are really at the top end of technical degrees. We're not talking about political science. I mean, there's nothing wrong with political science. My best friend is a political scientist.
School of Governance.
I think that's valuable. I just want to go to a couple of comments here because we've got lots of people who want to ask you things and disagree with you. I see Selby Bupape says, I would disagree with the prof that Mbeki didn't create a capable successor. Phumzile was his deputy president and is still capable, and she went on to prove that with the UN. Mm-hmm. So he was grooming her. He didn't groom Jacob Zuma very well.
Can I disagree with that? Because because I was there. He went on to appoint initially Jacob Zuma as his deputy president against all rational and pragmatic advice. If your reader goes back to the year of 1997's Polokwane conference of the ANC, reads the newspapers from the Star to the Sunday Times, the Mail and Guardian, any newspaper, and see the debate for that year where everyone in the country cautions, everyone who's rational thinking, cautions Mbeki, and even the rational thinkers inside the ANC, and even Mandela said to him, do not appoint Jacob Zuma as your deputy. Find a younger
person. At the public lecture, and I asked the question specifically, did he not, because he spoke about counter-revolutionaries taking over the party, I asked the question specifically, did he not leave the door open by not having a succession plan in place? And his answer was that he does not believe that a succession plan is the best way within, those were his words, within the political party, because comrades should do their work and the cream should rise to the top. Those were his words.
I mean, if you don't have a succession plan in any organization, including a political organization, you have to have a succession plan. If you don't have a succession plan, what kind of, I mean, do you see that poor leadership, poor political management? I mean, you know, not to have a succession plan, you have to have a succession plan.
Elvis Mliswa says, the executive of the ANC has Angie and you think the country's going anywhere. Congo Chris says, our Liberation Party has not moved beyond the Stalinist statecraft training they were given in the struggle. This is the key point holding South Africa back. Patrick says, our guest from last week, Mike Sham. I like Mike Sham's comment, always saying the ANC went and committed national suicide at Polokwane. So I think that's all kind of a bit of a depressing look. But what do you see as the future of the GNU? You've already gone on record saying that if the GNU fails, it's the ANC that will cause it to fail. What about ministries? What about leadership? I mean, a lot of people say that John Steenhuisen isn't much of a leader. People say that actually it's all being controlled by Helen, who was our guest 2 weeks ago from behind the scenes. You know these people. What is the role of the smaller parties in that GNU? Mm-hmm. Do they have a role, or is it just ANC and DA and they'll just roll over everybody?
And just in addition to that, if the GNU fails, what then for the future of any of the parties in the GNU?
Yeah.
I'm excited about the GNU, not only because obviously I've got conflict of interest because I was involved in helping them. Okay, so I'll put that aside.
You were the midwife.
The master architect.
You were the midwife.
But I've advised the party, some of the parties on it. But the thing is, what is so exciting about it, the first thing in the sense that it is brought hope to the country, and so on. And I, you know, hope may sound not really concrete, but it is very concrete because you cannot have, if people are hopeless in the country, we'll never be able to create jobs or growth. I mean, many African countries, for example, fail because people are just hopeless. I mean, if you ever travel to many countries, African countries have failed, people have given up. They're given up and they go to other countries, the best leave. No one wants to make investment because there's a sense of same people in power forever who's going to do nothing. And the same people are going to vote for them back in power. There's no accountability, hopelessness. So just the idea of having new people, new non-ANC people, have given people some hope. And some people may say, well, it's false hope. Oh, you know, some people may say, well, you know, it's going to, they're going to be disappointed again. Let's put that aside. Just the idea that there are new people in. I mean, we've had people in this government, anti-government, who's been there since 1994, who's failed terribly. What new things are going to bring in? So the exciting thing now is that the non-ANC partners are really under pressure to perform, because if they don't perform, let's say a DA or IFP, if their ministers do not perform, I mean, they're going to be out of in the next election. Yeah? Mm-hmm. They need to prove. This is the first time that they've been in government as a national. They, well, you know, beyond the IFP and so on, when they were part of the GNU of Mandela. But they have to prove we haven't been in a situation before that, because we had the ANC that people voted over and over again because based on race, based on the past, and all of those things. Because once a country is in that dynamics where people vote just over and over for the same party because of color, because of the past and so on, the country will go nowhere. Yeah, because what is the incentive for a leader or anyone who's getting elected to say, oh yes, I know my color people is going to vote for me, my village is going to vote for me, I can do whatever I want. Company elections, I give people a t-shirt and so on, and we back, and I can blame the whites, I can blame the others, the foreigners and so on, and people are just going to, oh yeah, vote for me again. So there's not going to be any accountability. Now, for the first time, we have that. And the exciting part of this, the 29 May elections, actually, is that people I think they've started to say, actually, we're going to begin to vote on performance. So that sips the country.
I know it's 8 o'clock, and please indulge me with one last question about the people and the electorate and the people who vote.
Yes. Yeah.
If we consider that the number of people who actually showed up to vote is the lowest turnout we have ever had.
Yeah.
So I would put to you that the people have already lost hope in this government. This is why they don't show up to the polls. And them not showing up to the polls, if 60% of the people don't show up to the polls, that 40 that has showed up may have hope, but the other 60 does not. They don't believe.
Yeah.
They are not in it. That's the one thing. The second thing is our education.
Yeah.
We have regressed terribly when it comes to education. You were talking about matric results. Only 30% of the kids who start school in grade one actually end up writing. So while we are excited about a 70% pass rate, it's only 70% of 30% of the people. So are we, at the risk of ending the show on such a downer, have the people not already checked out?
People have checked out before the elections. Clearly, I mean, you know, in our last general elections in May, more people stayed at home and didn't vote than people who voted. And that is important also for parties to understand. I mean, there are parties who think the whole of society is behind them, and then they only get 9%. I mean, and so on. So that's a very important, you know, that people must also come down to earth. And so on. To say there's a whole lot of people have given up hope. But the GNU has the opportunity really to make a difference. If they can deliver on the basics, and I'm saying, they're low hanging fruit. If the state can't deliver, just be pragmatic and say, can we have business or the NGOs to deliver? And can we support that to do that? Can we create some kind of jobs? Even something as what a GNU needs to do is get a couple of million young blacks into jobs. For example, can start a year-long community service. I mean, even in the UK during the elections, you know, Rishi Sunak, I mean, he came up with a year-long community service for young people. We can, like in Switzerland, for example, I mean, they send young people to the military not to go and fight in the Congo, of course, but I mean to get practical skills and to get some kind of discipline that we don't get in our families that's broken, in our townships that are toxic and toxic masculinity and so on. So, you know, low-hanging fruits, and that will give people hope again. And I think, you know, so to give people hope again and bring the people that have given up, bring them back into politics, the GNU will need to deliver, at least to some extent. I don't think people realistically think that things will change overnight. But, you know, if they see green suits of things happening, the police actually being accountable, politicians taken to jail for corruption, departments actually beginning to work, you go to Home Affairs, you treat it decently at least. And so on. If things begin to happen, so is the public service begin to move around, people get held accountable. And in the meantime, while some things can't be turned around in the state, then maybe the private sector, NGOs begin to deliver on services, you know, in the meantime, until part of the state becomes recover.
Sure. It's a big ask.
That wasn't bad. That's not a bad way to end. A little bit of a solution.
Right. Listen, I'm sorry it's taken so long to get you in the studio. You've been a very busy man and we've been trying. So I'm delighted you finally got here. But thank you for spending some time with us this morning. There's still lots of questions. I'm afraid we're not going to have time for all of them. And some very, very wild ideas going on here too. Someone said just now, make Pieter Groenewald president and Gayton McKenzie deputy.
Yes, maybe do that. Richard,
I don't think that's a possibility. But keep dreaming, my friend. Keep dreaming. You know, it does occur to me that people are, as Pumi says, kind of, let's just see what happens now. Which is still better than we hate everything that government do. And who knows, if people like you are in the mix, making things happen from within or without, I'm happier than if less people are involved, and especially if it becomes completely partisan. Because party politics, I think, have brought us to a lot of dead ends. Let's hope that this is the beginning of those green shoots you talk about. Thank you so much, Prof. William Gumede.
Oh, Prof, you were also very funny.
Yes. We've got to catch up with you again soon. That is it for the Burning Platform for this week. We have a lineup of really incredible programming here, though. So if you haven't subscribed and liked already, go and join Podcast Party. We will be back with another Burning Platform, Pumi Mashiqo and I, next week, Thursday. Don't miss it.